Hi, everybody. It's Trisha.
Love Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. We're already having technical issues, and we haven't even started yet. That's the bizarre thing. Welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. If we're a little bit haywire, it's because we look like we've stuck our fingers in a light socket and our hair is going in 18 different directions because we barely, literally, got the show on the air as the countdown went down to 1 second. Anyway, tonight we're going to be discussing a very disturbing case. It's the case of missing 10-year-old Jessica Ridgway. And Mark Klass will be our guest. We'll be talking with Mark in just a moment. But I want to mention something about Tony Ingram and the Morgan Ingram case. I had Tony Ingram on a few weeks ago. Tony is the woman whose daughter, Morgan, was found dead in her room. Tony claims there was a stalker and that the stalker terrorized the family and Morgan and that somehow the stalker got into Morgan's room the night in December of 2011 and killed her. Thanks to the incredible sleuthing on Web Sleuths, and I mean it was absolutely incredible, there was no stalker. There was no case. It is a suicide, according to the coroner's report. And I have to agree with that. Web Sleuth's co-owner, too, agrees with it. And we have found out that the things that Tony told us and then that were on the police report don't match. So what we've done is, according to what we can see, and this may change, and if it changes, we will change our minds. But we have closed down the discussion on the Morgan Ingram case because as far as we can tell, there was no crime anywhere. So I feel like I need to apologize to the listeners of Trisha's True Crime Radio because when I brought Tony on, I believed what she was saying, and I believe she believes what she is saying, and I'm not saying she's lying, I'm just saying her interpretation is quite a bit different than ours after seeing the evidence. So hopefully next time I'll be a little more diligent in trying to get the correct information before I go on the air. Okay, Kimster, are you there, my dear?
I'm barely here today.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Kimster, we have such a wonderful guest with us, Mark Klass, and we're going to be talking to him in just a moment. But first, let me just update everybody on the Jessica Ridgway case. Now, her mother last saw Jessica walk out the door heading to school in Westminster, Colorado, Friday morning. Now, yesterday, about 800 volunteers searched the area, came up with nothing. Well, this morning at about 8:15 a.m., a backpack with Jessica's name on a water bottle was found in Superior, Colorado. It's about 10 minutes away, about 13 miles away. Now, we have someone on our show tonight. He has lived this nightmare. And one thing, I remember so many things that Mark Klass says to me, but one of the things that really just sticks in my heart is you don't want to be a member of this club. It's a very exclusive club, and unfortunately, it's a tragic one. Mark's daughter, Polly, was kidnapped and murdered in 1993. And Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight. I really appreciate it. Mark, are you there?
Yeah.
Mark. Oh, there you are. Hi. Thank you so much. How are you doing today?
We're very, very busy. Today's a good day. Yeah, sure.
Is it?
Today's fine. We're very busy. We're still looking for Sierra Lamar. We're involved in a lot of the California ballot propositions that have to do with criminal justice. We're stretched very thin, but there's always plenty to do, and it's interesting and exciting work.
Well, it's interesting because I believe you are talking to us from a deep cave in Afghanistan. That's what it sounds like. Where are you?
I'm at home.
There you go. You live in. I didn't know you lived in a cave in Afghanistan. That's amazing. Mark, tell us about, there is something going on in California, several things. Why don't you tell us about the proposition that you're working on and who's against it and why?
Well, sure. There's three of them that we're working on. One of them is an effort to overthrow the death penalty and replace it with life without the possibility of parole. And they're using a financial excuse for this most recent attempt to overthrow the death penalty or overturn the death penalty in California, but it's all based upon numbers that the opponents of the death penalty cooked up. So it's really a pretty cynical effort to override the law and override the will of the people. So we are recommending that people vote no on this effort to overthrow the death penalty. That's Proposition 34. The next one that we're working on is Proposition 35, which is regarding human trafficking and updating the internet to require registered sex offenders to include internet identifiers such as email addresses and internet handles, IM handles, those kinds of things. And the purpose of that is so that the social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter will be able to use that information to scrub or otherwise monitor relevant profiles on their online communities. But it does do much more than that. It increases penalties for human traffickers, that being the pimps. It provides services for the victims of human trafficking. In this particular instance, we're talking about America's children that find themselves caught up in this whole thing. And it really addresses a lot of those issues. You don't have to prove force or coercion in a human trafficking case involving a minor anymore. So in essence, the girls and young men that find themselves hung up in this and involved with pimps will be treated as victims and no longer be treated as criminals. And then finally, we're working on Proposition 36, which is an effort to overthrow California's three strikes and you're out law. And we are recommending that people vote no on that for the simple reason that California's three strikes and you're out law works beautifully.
Well, that's just
really,
it.
Really well the way it is.
Tell me this. Is the three strikes and you're out law, is it three felonies, three violent felonies? How does that work?
Well, the first two have to be serious or violent felonies. So you have to be involved in something that's really pretty heinous. That includes residential burglaries, by the way. And anything, you know, on a higher threshold than that, including assaults, including battery, including kidnapping, rape, murder, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third felony can be any kind of a felony, can trigger a third strike. And the theory behind it is that, number one, a small percentage of criminals are committing a large percentage of the crimes. And then, number two, if they haven't learned, knowing that this harsh penalty is looming over them, if they haven't learned to live a law-abiding life and continue to commit crime regardless of how petty that crime is, and they get caught doing it, then they have demonstrated that they're not willing to live within the rules of society, and if found guilty and charged with a third strike, they'll then serve a 25-year to life sentence. It's an indeterminate sentence. And currently in California, there are about 8,800 people serving the third strike. They represent 6.6% of our prison population. Each and every one of those individuals has at least two serious or violent criminal convictions behind them already, and each and every one of them has had the advantage of prosecutors being able not to charge strikes if they wish, judges being able to strike strikes if they feel it's in the furtherance of justice, an appeals court system that will take a look at the prosecution, and if they feel that the defendant's rights were somehow violated, then they can overturn a third strike sentence as well. And then ultimately and finally, the parole board would have a decision in that as well. And so my feeling is that, you know what, this is a system that works well. The judge has decided not to strike. The prosecutor has decided to go ahead and press these charges. These people are behind bars. Crime has been down 50% in California.
Whoa.
Three strikes in the first pass. And I see absolutely no reason on the face of the earth to change it one bit.
I can't imagine why anybody would want to. That's interesting because some of the misunderstanding about the law is some people think that it's black and white, solid, and there's no discretion. There's discretion all through this law as far as the judge and the prosecutor, right? It's constant discretion.
Well, that's absolutely correct. No, that's absolutely and totally correct. And that's the whole point, is that each prosecutor, and this is how it is throughout the country, each county has an elected district attorney or state's attorney, as they're sometimes called. They're responsible for prosecutions in the state and or in their county, and they then have the discretion in California as to whether or not to go ahead and prosecute as a strike. Now, what the opponents want is a cookie-cutter formula, one size fits all. But I think that the crime issues facing a rural county such as Lake County, which is very large, very rural, and has a small law enforcement presence, those needs are very different than, say, an urban environment like San Francisco, which has a very strong law enforcement presence, which is a very small county. It's 49 square miles. And then also, our prosecutors are answerable to the people. They have to be elected every 4 years, and if the citizens don't like the way they're prosecuting three strikes or doing other aspects of their job, then they will get booted out, and they'll bring somebody in who will have an opportunity then to please the public.
We're talking with Mark Klass. He is the director of the Klass Kids Foundation. His daughter, Polly, was kidnapped and murdered in 1993. And since then, Mark has dedicated his life to making sure that our children are safe. Mark, what is the argument on the other side of the three strikes? I can't imagine what it could be. What's the opposition?
Well, again, it's a financial consideration. They say that it will cost the state too much money to be able to house these people and a geriatric population of offenders for the rest of their lives. But the reality is that these guys are not geriatric, that most mm-hmm. of these guys have been caught and captured and sentenced when they're in their 20s or early 30s. They'll all be eligible for parole, and the vast majority will probably get it by the time they are in their late 50s or early 60s. And I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that can be considered a geriatric population in this day and age when people are typically living into their 90s and sometimes even past the century mark. So I think that that's a false assumption right there. And I think that there are a lot of the other reasons that they feel it should be overturned include they believe there should be a cookie-cutter approach, that it should be one-size-fits-all, and they pose the false argument that you shouldn't put somebody behind bars for 25 years to life for something that might not be a serious or violent felony. And the examples that they point out are things like the pizza thief mm-hmm. or somebody that steals DVDs from a Walmart or somebody that is involved in other types of shoplifting. But the reality is that each one of these guys already has a serious and or violent criminal history, and that, in fact, in California, the average third striker has 5 felony convictions. Now, I would ask your gentle and wonderful audience to just consider that for a minute. How many felony convictions do they have?
None, exactly.
And if you actually have a felony conviction, at what point do you say, well, boy, I don't want to go to prison or I don't want to go back to prison. I'm going to change my behavior and start living a law-abiding life. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to stop stalking people. I'm going to stop robbing people. I'm going to stop raping women. I'm going to stop murdering little girls. And I am going to try to do the right thing by myself, for my family, for my God, and for my society.
Exactly, Mark. And that's what people need to remember. And another thing that you have always said that I always remember is, why do we need another victim? Why do we need another violent crime to prove that this guy is going to be trouble? He's already had at least 2, probably more.
Well, and in fact, let me give you an amazing example. And I don't have his name in front of me, but there's a character down in Los Angeles. And in fact, Los Angeles is one of the district attorney of Los Angeles is one of the few district attorneys in the state that is in favor of overturning three strikes. But there is one individual who was a two-striker. The district attorney had 4 different opportunities to charge him as a third striker. In other words, he kept committing crime after crime after crime. And instead of charging him as a third striker, the guy would cycle through our system in just a few months, get back out onto the street, until ultimately, Tricia, He was arrested and convicted of quadruple murder.
Oh,
so the whole
gosh.
Purpose is to try to avoid the quadruple murder or the rape or any of a number of heinous crimes that can either end or ruin or otherwise inhibit somebody's life for the rest of their days.
Exactly. Those people don't have a right to have us living in fear. That's just absolutely ridiculous. Mark, what do you
think? That's something else entirely. We didn't even talk about that. I mean, we're not even talking about the victimization yet,
right,
or the threat to society, or the fact that the communities do live in fear of these guys. And the whole point is, Tricia, California crime is down so much since three strikes that it's off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the typical argument is that when the economy is bad, crime goes up. Well, you know what? We've just gone through the worst economy that we've gone through in 70 years. And you know what? Crime didn't spike in California. So I think that the theory is correct. If a small percentage of the criminals are committing a large percentage of the crimes, and those individuals are taken out and being housed in one of our prisons for 25 years to life, we won't have any more crime, and that's exactly what's happened in the state of California. It's proof that it works.
That's what's amazing to me is that somebody, or a whole bunch of people, don't think that it does. How do you feel about it? Have there been any polls to suggest how people are going to vote? I imagine it's going to be safe, but I don't know.
No, there are polls. In fact, on all three of those propositions, on the one to overturn the death penalty, that proposition is losing, and that doesn't surprise me. It's cynical. It's not fair. It's based on many false presumptions, and the majority of citizens in California are in favor of the death penalty. So the effort to overturn the death penalty is losing. The one to impose stronger sentences on human traffickers and update Megan's Law to the 20th century is polling very, very strong, and that will probably pass. My prediction is somewhere between 70% and 90%. And then, unfortunately, the three strikes proposition, the one to overturn three strikes, probably will win because there's a lot of out-of-state money coming in, and the individuals that are opposing Proposition 36 really don't have any money at all. It really consists of a fellow named Mike Reynolds, who wrote this law after his own daughter was murdered in 1992, and with a little help from me when I can. I called him up and said, you know, Mike, if I can help you out, let me know, man. I'd be more than happy to because I believe in what he did, and I believe in this law.
You have been very instrumental in this law. You're being shy now, and I'm shocked that you're shy because you've been really instrumental and just working like crazy to make sure that this law stays intact. We'll just have to keep our fingers crossed that maybe the voters of California will have an epiphany and make it, keep it safe, keep the three strikes safe.
Either an epiphany or somebody will finance a campaign so that we can get the truth out before the California voting public. It's
Perfect.
One of those two things.
If I had the money, Mark, you know I'd give it to you in a heartbeat to do it. So, okay, now let's see. Mark, we have another case here that is just chilling to the bone. It's Jessica Ridgway. I'm sure you're very familiar with this, correct?
I am familiar with it, of course.
Now, interestingly enough, before we get into the particulars of the case, I want to do a little comparison here to show how much your work has changed the way we view the missing and the missing children now. When it was finally reported that Jessica was missing, unfortunately, whoever took her has a 12-hour head start.
Yeah.
When it was reported, I mean, all of a sudden, all these things went into action. You know, there was the police, there was an Amber Alert, there was all of this. Yet when Polly went missing, the police didn't even, the police didn't even talk about it over the radio because they didn't want the word to get out. Is that correct?
That's in its simplest form, but that's exactly right. They did not want Polly's kidnapping released to the press because, well, who knows why?
Well, they just didn't want to panic anybody.
I'll tell you why, because they didn't have a plan, Tricia.
Right.
That's why, because they didn't know what to do, nor did they know how to do it. So they took the route that was the safest to them, which was to keep the information in-house and hope to hell that something happened to resolve the case before it got out into the public. And possibly the end result of that was the murder of my child.
Absolutely. And didn't they pull over Polly's killer in the car, not knowing, because the police did not broadcast it over their radio? So a couple of cops, didn't they help him out of a ditch or something like that? I can't remember the exact story. And because the cops didn't know.
No, that is the exact story. What they did is they made the decision that they would not broadcast the information over the radio frequencies to their deputies in the squad cars, because they were afraid that the press might be monitoring those frequencies, and then the press would have known about it. So when the two guys did confront the kidnapper on a rural private road after he had run his car into a ditch about an hour after Paulie was kidnapped, they helped him out of the ditch and sent him on his way, instead of totally unaware that my child had been kidnapped.
Oh, you know what? That just makes my stomach turn.
Yeah, me too.
God. Well, because of people like you and Amber's mom for the Amber Alert, and so many others, unfortunately, who are in that horrible, terrible club of having a child that was kidnapped and murdered, because of your hard work, things are different now. And let's talk about the Jessica Ridgway case. As I mentioned earlier, we're speaking with Mark Klass, Polly Klass's father from the Klass Kids Foundation. And this morning at 8:15, a backpack with Jessica's name on a water bottle was found in Superior, Colorado. That's about 10 minutes away from Westminster, Colorado. Mark, what have you heard about this case? What has come to your attention?
Well, I think the thing that stands out more than anything else is that another child has been kidnapped and brought to school. You know, I mean, at what point are we going to realize that these are the hunting grounds for predators? At school bus stops, we hear about this all the time. You and I, in fact, went up to Omaha, Nebraska.
That's right.
The Amber Harris case, which
I was just going
to
say
exactly
that.
About that. And the little girl down in Florida a couple of years ago was kidnapped on her way home from school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, number one, the kids. 10-year-old kids shouldn't be walking these routes by themselves. That's absolutely ludicrous on absolutely every level. So that stands out. Another thing that really stands out, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but from everything that I've been able to determine, this was a situation where a mother and a little girl lived in a house and almost lived separate lives.
Right, the grandmother was there, right.
But the mother works at night and the little girl walks by herself to school in the morning,
right,
just as her mother is getting home. I think that raises a couple of red flags in itself. And then the whole fact that finally they were able to discover something relevant to the case. Now, you know, we're working on the Sierra Lamar case here in California, and it was very, very similar. It was a young girl, although she was 5 years older, a young girl walking to the school bus, who never made it to the school bus. But some days later, 2 days later, her book bag is found. So in that sense, it's almost exactly the same crime. Now, in Sierra's case, they were able to pull relevant information or relevant evidence off of that book bag and its contents that led them to a suspect who they have arrested for the kidnap and murder of Sierra, yet we still have not found her remains or her body or her, and the slight chance that she might still be alive. So they've got a great piece of evidence now. They have a direction. They know that this person went up Highway 36 at least 6 miles. Now it's just going to be a matter of great detective work and the community continuing to respond as they have been for the last 2 days, and search for this girl until she, too, is brought home and this case is resolved.
Mark, you mentioned earlier the Amber Harris case in Nebraska. That is one that Brad Dennis, myself, and you, we went to Nebraska, spent quite a bit of time with Amber's family. And another situation, this is how things can change so quickly, so horribly. on something so innocent. The bus driver, Amber was on the bus, she was 12 years old, and she convinced the bus driver to stop like a block away from the regular stop because it was closer to her house. I mean, what bus driver wouldn't want to do that for a kid so the kid could get home quicker? She ended up walking past a predator's house. He grabbed her and murdered her. And it's similar in, I can't remember how much longer, but at least a few days, maybe even a week later, all of a sudden Amber's backpack shows up just sitting outside on top of a garbage can. This is the same thing. All of a sudden it shows up. And if I remember correctly, they believe that somebody in the house with this predator put it out there for everyone to find. Like they wanted, in an odd way, to help. Fortunately, that man has been found guilty and will never get out again. But here we have almost the exact same thing, another backpack. But getting back to the bus driver was fired for that, and he will never be the same. Amber's mother, of course, talked to the bus driver and said, "It's not your fault. Don't you dare blame yourself. You know, I understand why you did it." And the family holds no blame on the bus driver, but he will never be the same. I think his life is pretty much destroyed after he did something just seemingly so innocent. But Mark, I think sometimes, especially with single women struggling, you know, it's hard when you're a single mom. You know, Jessica's father lives in another state, and last I read, he was still at work. He didn't get on a plane and come out here. And so obviously this woman doesn't have a lot of help. We don't know what her boyfriend's situation is. We do know that the grandmother is there to help her get ready in the morning. I'm not sure if the grandmother lives at the house or not. So it's difficult, I think, with a lot of single moms, and sometimes you just got to let the kids go off by themselves, even though it's so dangerous. And what I'm hoping that will come from this is that if they can get groups of kids to go together, even if an adult can't help them, get kids in the neighborhood to go together, you know, or take turns driving to the bus stop, or take turns monitoring. There's got to be a monitoring system from point A to point B, from the house to the bus stop, or to point C to the school, so that the kids know that eyes are on them to protect them. And the predators know that as well. Don't you agree?
I would. If my daughter was walking three blocks to hook up with her friends or to hook up with her school bus or to hook up with her school, and I had just gotten off work, I would walk her that three blocks. It would give me an opportunity to spend some time with her, to bond with her. I've never had a job, and I've worked graveyards. I've never had a job where as soon as I get home, I go to bed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's wind down time. There's always some kind of wind down time. But again, this isn't about the mother. The mother didn't commit a crime. The mother probably overlooked some safety issues. This is about somebody out there who may very well live on that route. And let's keep that in mind. Somebody who may very well live on that route or live up in the Superior area. They've got two crime scenes now. They've got the location that she disappeared from, which is somewhere in that three-block area. So what they're going to do is they're going to talk to every resident along that route who saw her that morning, who sees her regularly, who's a registered sex offender in that community, who's a sexual predator in that community. Can they account for their time? Are they subject to Jessica's law? Are they wearing GPS devices? I mean, there's a lot of investigation to do, and they have evidence now, so hopefully they'll be able to figure out what happened. Then there's always, I guess, Tricia, the remote possibility that she just wandered off, but I don't think you, I, or anybody in your listening audience believes that for 1 minute.
Absolutely not. We're talking with Mark Klass, Polly's dad, and the head of ClassKids.org and the Klass Kids Foundation. We're talking about the disappearance of 10-year-old Jessica Ridgway from Westminster, Colorado. Jessica's backpack, it hasn't been confirmed, but it's looking like it was her backpack, was found about 10 minutes away in Superior, Colorado. Mark, there was a huge search yesterday, about 800 people. We've seen this happen where the perpetrator has actually showed up to search. I cannot remember the case, but it was a teenage boy showed up to search and was, you know, really trying to help out and found out that he had the body under his bed. How closely were the police looking at the searchers, do you think?
Well, I mean, our protocol Tricia, as you well know, is to get a copy of everybody's driver's license that comes in to aid in one of these efforts. For that very reason, we register them. We obviously can't do immediate background checks on 800 people for an awful lot of reasons, but you register them, you know who they are, you've got their relevant information, so that police, and then you turn that information all over to law enforcement so that, you know, they can use it perhaps to aid in their investigation. But it's very, very important. In our case, and I remember this from one of the first days of the trial, in our case, we walked into court one day, and the killer's family was sitting on the across the way in the courtroom, and there was this one really odd-looking man sitting there who I distinctly remembered from coming to our search center, and it turned out to be the killer's brother-in-law. The guy that he was squatting with in the time after he kidnapped Polly. So the police approached him and asked him, were you at the Polly Center? And he said, oh, yeah, I was. I was just there to see what I could do to help. Well, again, Tricia, maybe, but really, you think? I doubt it.
No.
I doubt it. I think he was there just doing some scouting for his brother-in-law to find out to find out what he could find out.
This is off the subject, but is Polly's killer going to ever be put to death, or is he going to die in prison?
Well, let's hope he at least dies in prison. Again, he's on death row with 728 other baby killers, cop killers, serial killers, and mass murderers, and there is an effort right now to save their souls.
Can't imagine why.
There's an effort right now that says basically it'll cost us too much. Again, they use this argument. It'll cost us too much to continue this appeals process, this endless appeals process, and to provide them with government guaranteed health care until they die as old men and in a few cases old women. And what they're claiming they want to do is they want to assimilate them into the general population and have them work to pay restitution to the victims of the families of their victims. Well, exactly how does that work that Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, who terrorized Los Angeles for a number of years back in the 80s, is going to assimilate into any kind of a general population anywhere on the face of the earth? Me how that's going to work, and exactly what kind of work do they expect Richard Ramirez to do to pay the victims of the families of his victims? It's an absurdity.
It is absurd. And you know, Mark, I'm going to just get on my soapbox here for just a moment. Nobody ever wants to see a person who did not kill someone put to death. That's why I have no problem if there's DNA testing that comes out later. Let's do it to make sure. I really want the people on death row, I want it to be certain that there is no question that they are the killer. I have no problem, you know, doing whatever we need to do to make sure that we have the right person on death row. But
Listen. Over of the 7,900 and some odd individuals who have been on death row since 1977, there have been 18 DNA exonerations. 18 out of almost 8,000 people.
And that, you know what? That's good, because that shows that it's working. That shows that it's working. Even though it's a small amount, that's okay. You know, I think that's great, because they're using the DNA to exonerate. But obviously, the vast, huge majority have not been exonerated and are guilty. But here's the thing, Mark. Here's the thing that people have got to realize. It's not about deterrent. To me, it's about taking a member of society who no longer, not only doesn't contribute, a lot of people don't contribute, but he is a danger to us all. He is a danger. And what do you do when there is a danger? You get rid of the danger. That's the only way we can guarantee that person will never, ever kill again, is if they're in the grave. I don't like the death penalty. I wish there was something else, but there isn't. That's the only way we can make sure that Polly's killer never kills again. Scott Peterson doesn't kill again. Richard Ramirez doesn't kill again. That's the only way we can guarantee it right now in our society. And, you know, I don't know if it's a deterrent or not. That doesn't enter into my argument anyway, and I don't know if you agree or not.
Yes, of course I agree.
Okay.
It's about
punishment,
too.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
When you take it down to its simplest form, of course it's a deterrent. I mean, Gacy and Bundy have not, and Dahmer have not killed since, have they?
Exactly. That is,
and
that's proof.
And they're gone. And these characters still also have an influence on society. I think people have to remember that, too. Remember Timothy McVeigh? Of
Very
course
well.
You do. Everybody remembers Timothy McVeigh. Well, this guy dominated our news headlines. He dominated our dinner conversation. He seemed to dominate everything in the years after he blew up the Muir building in Oklahoma City in April of 1995. But you know what? As soon as they executed that piece of crap, it ended. Nobody was talking about him anymore. His
right.
influence ended right there and right then.
Exactly. And that's what people need to realize. That's why we need the death penalty, because we have these evil, evil people out there. Sorry, I got off track there. We're talking with Mark Klass, Polly's dad, and we're also talking about the Jessica Ridgway case. It's a missing 10-year-old girl in Colorado. You mentioned, Mark, that perhaps the person who took Jessica might live right there. We know how that can be, how common that can be. Daniel Van Dam, the next-door neighbor. How closely do the police now look at the neighbors? Do they really put them through the ringer now, or how does that usually work?
Well, listen, I mean, they're not going to be too harsh on people. I mean, you know, they're going to do their work. They're going to look at everybody closely. They're going to interrogate everybody. They're going to pay special attention to those individuals who have criminal histories, but particularly those individuals who are on the Megan's Law list. And hopefully by using that information to help them aid in their investigation, they'll be able to come up with the answer sooner rather than later. It happened recently in, oh my goodness, it happened recently in Utah again. It was somebody right down the street from a little girl.
Yes.
Broke into her house and kidnapped her and did what they do, you know, that's what they do. They break in, they kidnap, they rape, they murder, and then they somehow think that they can get away with it.
It's just absolutely sickening. Everybody listening, it is Mark Klass with us today. Our chat room, we're having some technical difficulties, so I can't see the questions. So if you do have a question or a comment, don't hesitate to call. Give us a call, 760-825-0933. That's 760-825-0933. Are there any plans for the Klass Kids Search Center to go to Colorado to search for Jessica?
Well, as you know, and as everybody in Web Sleuth knows, since we've all worked together for so long, Klass Kids has to be requested by either the jurisdictional law enforcement agency and or a member of the immediate family. We don't just show up.
Right.
There are others who do that, as I understand it, but we have very specific protocols that we use before we get involved in a case. So what would happen with the Pauley Center, Tricia, is they would make a call. We would assign a caseworker to the case. They would gather all of the relevant information. They'd make all of the relevant confirmations. Then they would make an assessment of the situation. And as you know, we can offer a variety of services, anywhere from a consultation with the family to working as a liaison with either law enforcement or the media, to bringing Brad and maybe another member out of the team out to the location to organize a volunteer search effort, and then put the full weight of Klass Kids behind it, which I think is a considerable weight sometimes.
Well, it really is. I'm thinking of the Sierra Lamar case when the Klass Kids Search Center showed up there with Brad Dennis. I mean, you had a lot of people with trained dogs that were certified. You had just hundreds of people showing up. The Klass Kids Search Center is a powerful force to be reckoned with, and you certainly do go in there and help the community wherever you go. Mark, if by chance the mom happens to hear this, Jessica's mother, what advice would you give her? What would you say to her?
Oh, well, I think it's very clear. You just continue to work with law enforcement. You continue to respond to media requests. And you look up on the klasskids.org for our search center and give us a call, and we'll be happy to help in any way that we possibly can. There's nothing that we would like more than to help bring this child home.
And Mark, you know, we are right behind you as well. The members of Web Sleuths, whatever you need, you just say the word and we are right there for you. We are your invisible army getting you food or whatever you need, my dear, right?
There's nothing invisible about you or Web Sleuths. But I know what you mean, sweetheart.
Thank you, Mark. And give my love to Violet, everybody. Mark Klass from the Klass Kids Foundation. We'll be talking to you again soon, Mark. You take care.
Thank you, Trish.
Bye-bye.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Actually. Yeah, we're going to St. Louis. That's right. Thanks, Mark.
Yes, bye-bye.
We'll be in St. Louis in a couple of weeks. We're going to do a print-a-thon. This is another thing Mark does, is the Klass Kids print-a-thon. This is where we go to a location, and Mark has this incredible equipment. It's digital fingerprinting. Parents bring their kids. They get the digital fingerprints. We give them a DNA kit. But mostly what we do there, Mark, and this is what Mark does, is he talks to the parents about safety. We don't keep a database. This is just for in the highly unlikely possibility that their child goes missing, they'll have their DNA and their fingerprints ready for them on hand. But Mark likes to talk to them about safety. And one of the things that Mark does talk about, and I always bring this up to people, you know, Polly's window was open. It was open. It was, you know, it was a warm night. Who wouldn't leave their window open? If her window had been locked, very good chance that Richard Allen Davis would just move on. And if you notice, Mark never says Richard Allen Davis's name. He calls him the killer. And I do too when I'm around him because I don't want to bring up his name either. What a scumbag. A few years ago, he tried to commit suicide in prison. I'm like, let him go. Let him do it. But apparently, from what the reports that have come out of prison is, he is bullied in prison and tormented in prison for what he did to Polly, and I have no sympathy for that man. However, again, it's a horrible cycle. He grew up in an abusive household. No excuse, I don't care, but we need to find out how these killers are created to stop them from being created. Information and learning is a good thing. That doesn't mean you're sympathetic if you want to find out somebody's background and find out why they did it. So that's what makes me crazy when I watch Nancy Grace and someone wants to find out about their background. She accuses them of having a bleeding heart and, you know, wanting to coddle them, and that's not it at all. I want to know why we have so many serial killers and why we have kids who can't walk down the street because somebody's going to grab them. What are we doing and how can we stop it? Okay, now I'm all worked up. Kimster, are you there, my darling? Kimster?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good, good, good. So, pretty interesting interview, don't you think? Isn't Mark the best?
Yes, he absolutely is. You know he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's a great, great guy. Okay, Kimster, we have a very interesting Web Sleuth hot cold case. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, we do, Tricia. Wait a minute. What about the intro?
There you go. That's even better than last week's. You're getting good.
Well, yeah, and we've been having technical difficulties like crazy tonight.
I haven't had
any in a while.
I know. Well, it does keep us on our toes, doesn't it? But I think we're all smoothed out finally. As the show comes to a close, our technical difficulties are finally figured out. Anyway, the Web Sleuth Hot Cold Case. What is that, my dear?
This week's hot cold case is about missing Pamela June Ray. On August 12, 1992, Pamela Ray drove from her residence in Atlanta, Georgia, to Panama City, Florida. This was during the early morning with her children. They were 5 and 12. She wasn't able to find a place to stay for the night, and so she parked her car in the parking lot Will Height Apartments on Front Beach Road for the night. The apartments are called Parsons Place today, for those who might be familiar with them. Pamela was seen by 7 witnesses, including 2 police officers. She locked her door, and she left her children asleep in the back seat at about 5:30 a.m. Then she walked from the apartment lobby to the swimming pool area. She was followed by a Caucasian man. He'd been seen earlier in the morning urinating in public. Witnesses heard a woman screaming for help from that area of the pool at about the same time she was seen walking towards it, and she has never been seen again. That just creeps me out. I mean, the poor woman couldn't find a place to stay, and then, you know, I don't know if she was trying to find a phone booth. I mean, back in 1992, we didn't have cell phones all the time, you know.
Right.
I'm not sure why she left, but I wonder if she, because she was in an apartment complex, so I wonder if she was trying to find a phone booth or something mm-hmm. to make a phone call. There have been many tips and leads in this case, but none have helped law enforcement in finding her. One of the police officers who saw her that night has even undergone hypnosis and described the man who followed her as having light hair and light eyes. He was about 6 feet tall and weighed 150 pounds. He wore a striped shirt. A man resembling the officer's description was arrested for kidnapping and sexually assaulting a woman from Chipley, Florida, 5 months prior to Pamela going missing. Mm. The charges were dropped due to conflicting descriptions given by the victim, which is a drag, but
yeah.
She was probably so traumatized, you know, you can't be mad at her, but it's still
right.
A drag. Pamela had some history that sleuthers might discover while trying to find clues in this case. A bank clerk in Georgia mistakenly wired, get this, Tricia, this is everybody's dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bank clerk in Georgia mistakenly wired about $400,000 into Pamela's dad. Yeah, into Pamela's dad's bank account in 1989. Pamela, though, was indicted in 1992 and released on bond after being arrested for having helped spend some of the money. And her dad also, he has been paying it back, or he had been paying it back. It might be paid back by now, but can you imagine? If I had $400,000 suddenly appear in my account, I think I'd go to the bank the next day and say, I think we have a problem.
Yeah, I would be too scared to touch it. I would know I was being set up. Big time. Anyway, you're right.
Fortunately, these guys decided to try and spend it. Mm. However, if you guys find that out when you're out there sleuthing and Googling her name or whatever, I do want to let everyone know that investigators do not believe this has anything to do with her appearance. So don't waste too much time on that. If you want to help find clues to solve this case and give Pamela's family closure, please go to www.websleuths.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of Pamela along with a link to her thread. And if you're not a member of Web Sleuths, what do you do, Tricia?
By golly, oh my flippin' heck, you join. It's free. We just need an email address. We do not want your personal information, just an email address so we can verify that you're not a robot. That's basically it. It is free to join websleuths.com, and you jump in, and I'm going to say this till I die. Even if you think you cannot offer one thing, I want you to know you're wrong. You can offer encouragement. That is just as important, because let me tell you, families of murder victims read here, victims of crimes, the police, everybody reads Web Sleuths. So you can make a difference just by being there and saying, I'm here, I'm thinking of you, I'll say a prayer for you. Right, Kim? Stir?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So I want to see you guys all in there helping out. I'll see everybody in the unidentified forum.
Yeah, the unidentified forum, that's an amazing forum with Rain and Nemo's mom and so many others working hard to connect the family to a body that has been found. The body has been found, and then they try and find the family members to let them know that their loved one has passed away. And that's a lot of hard work that they do in those forums. The unidentified, Kimster, help me out.
The unclaimed.
I'm sorry, the unclaimed. The unclaimed is where they have identified the body, and now they just need to find the family members. And the people in the unclaimed form, that's what I was thinking of, Rain and Nemo's mom, they work so hard to find the family members to let them know their loved one has passed. And the unidentified forum, same thing. We have amazing people in there, don't we, Kimster?
Yes, we have a moderator in there, Carl Kay.
Carl,
who actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually does reconstructions of some of the bodies that have been found. So that's really amazing. You can get some idea of what they look like at Web Sleuths, where you can't get that anywhere else on the internet.
That's right. Carl Kay is truly an incredible human being, as well as so many people in the unidentified forum. And unfortunately, there are thousands and thousands of people unidentified, and there's thousands of families worried, sick, wondering where their loved ones are. And Carl and the people at Web Sleuths try hard to bring those families together. So I want to thank them as well. Kim, sir, I want to touch on something, and then we're going to have to wrap it up here. But we were talking with Mark Klass earlier about Jessica Ridgway. She is 10 years old. She went missing Friday as she was walking to school or to the school bus, and hasn't been seen since. Her backpack with a water bottle with her name on it was found in a town about 10 miles away. Now, Mark was a little hard on the mom. I understand, you know, when you're a single mom and the kid has walked back and forth, it's a neighborhood, you know, it's hard to think, I have to keep an eye on my child every second. I know that mother must be going through hell right now and blaming herself. But don't you kind of understand that, you know, if you look at the situation, like obviously it was different when we were growing up, but I walk a busy highway when I was 6 years old, you know? I mean, it was just different. And I'm thinking probably Jessica has lived there for a while and she knows the neighborhood and it wasn't that far and probably not in any busy streets. There was probably no reason to worry. There was no reason to think somebody would grab your daughter or your child. Don't you think? I feel so bad for this mother.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was young, lived in a small town, and I walked way far. In fact, I used to whine about it a lot. I'll tell you, I walked 10 miles in the snow. But, no, it wasn't that bad. But I walked a long, long way, and nobody ever even heard of these kinds of things. Now, when my kids were young, I was a single mom, not so much when my youngest – I got married when my youngest was pretty young, but my oldest one, he used to walk a long way, and I lived in Fresno, California, which is known to have high crime, but it was mostly adults that were shooting each other. I never heard of any children except for one little girl in Hanford, California. Nobody from the school or anywhere said that my son shouldn't walk after school. He would walk to the babysitters and then, you know, to some friend's house. Some friends of mine owned a bookstore, and he would walk there. And, you know, he would just call me when he got there, so I know that, you know, he didn't get hurt or something. Mm-hmm. But I never even knew about sexual predators grabbing children or anything like that. I really didn't. And so I think that the word needs to get, the schools need to educate the parents in case they don't know, because we're on Web Sleuths. You know, Mark has lost his daughter to, you know, a killer, you know, I'll say killer, because anything else I say, I don't know if it would be appropriate for radio, but, I think the schools, when the kids start out in kindergarten, that should be part of the protocol, honestly, is okay, parents, here's your new baby here, you know, you're bringing to kindergarten, and, here's your list of things you need to get them, their school list, and here's a list of things you need to know about keeping your child safe. And just, you know, have it be part of that, because, if I saw a little child walking around now alone, and I don't see them that much anymore, but if I did, you know, I kind of would keep my eye on them at this point.
And, absolutely.
And you listeners, if you're home during the day and you see the same kid walking home, keep an eye on them for them. You know, we got to watch out for these children too.
Exactly. That you're absolutely right, Kimster. And doesn't it shock you now, though, to see like a 12-year-old girl in a tank top walking alone along a street? I get just terrified when I see that now. I used to do that. Now when I see it, I do. I watch. I make sure. If I'm driving, sometimes I turn around and go back and make sure they're okay. I picked up four girls. They were 12 years old, hitchhiking at 10 at night once. I reamed them. Believe me. You know, I took them home. I talked to their parents. Oh, I couldn't believe it. But it was pretty scary. And they lived like 50 miles away. It was so shocking. I can't even tell you. But that's just it. We've got to watch out for each other. And I know this mother, I'm sure, is beating herself up because the daughter and maybe other kids have walked that way to school forever and there's never been a problem. But I think if we can organize something where, like I said, along the way, somebody is watching. the whole time. So, you know, you don't have to have people out there actually walking with the child, but, you know, people who are at home or getting ready for work, or there's just got to be something we can do to prevent this from happening, because one child being taken like this is one too many. It just is. And so we, like you said, keep an eye out for your neighbors and let's just help each other. Okay, now I feel like holding hands and singing Kumbaya. Maybe we'll do that later tonight. Oh, you know what I forgot? I forgot.
No.
The legal goo. Are you ready? The opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and the guests and are not connected in any way, shape, or form to WebSleuth.com LLC, which is a totally separate corporate entity. And we're not connected in any way to ForumsForJustice.org. We're just connected to moi, yours truly, Trisha Arrington Griffith. Well, Kimster, thank you so much. I'm sorry to give you such a scare. I literally didn't get my microphone fixed until the countdown hit 1 second, I think, is when I finally got it. So Kim was having a heart attack, and I'm used to it. Nothing doesn't faze me, you know. I figure if there's a problem, there's a problem. So Kim, sir, I'm sorry to give you a heart attack today.
Well, yes, we did go on the air with me having breathing problems, but I was able to catch my breath after a while.
You did good. And next week we're going to have a wonderful show. Who is our guest? I don't have a clue because everything can change so quickly. But I'll tell you what, on Trisha's True Crime Radio, we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.